start to put our bill together. And some of the bills are in bill form, but none of them are in possession of the committee at this particular time. So we just want an information about what your request is. How much money are you asking for? Why is this significant to all Minnesota taxpayers? And what is your vision for how your community will change if this is in your, if this reaches the capital investment bill that comes to the floor and maybe passes? We have, we're very optimistic about the future of the capital investment opportunities that we have before us. But we're not in the deciding stages yet. We're in the preparation stages, building the foundations, and this is the biggest crowd we've had so far. But maybe that's because it's more bills than we've had so far before us, or more presentations before us. Committee members have competing committees that they are attending tonight, and so people may get up and leave, and it has nothing to do with the presentation that's before us. So welcome, Representative Becker-Finn, and please tell us about your project that you're bringing forward for our consideration.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. So tonight, I'm glad if you follow the primacy and recency foundation, I'm glad that we're first, so hopefully you guys will remember me. So I'm here to talk about the Roseville, the Guidant John Rose Oval. We're asking for $5 million. And mostly I'm going to give most of my time to my testifiers here, but I did just want to say, for folks that aren't aware, the Oval in Roseville is the largest outdoor refrigerated ice sheet in the country, and as such, we're home to lots of great outdoor winter sports. If you're there any night of the week, there will be people ice skating, speed skating, bandy, hockey, youth hockey, adult hockey, you name it. It happens at the Oval, and folks from all over the region really come to the Oval and are able to take part in the great atmosphere we have there, and especially with the weather not always being predictable, the Oval is always cold and ready to be skated on. And so I encourage folks, we tried to invite everybody out to come skating, but it ended up being that absolute coldest day of the year. And but at any time, if any of you want to come ice skating at the Oval, you let me know, and I will gladly guide you. It's a beautiful, wonderful part of the greater Roseville community. And with that, I will turn it over to my testifiers. First, I have the city manager for the city of Roseville, Pat Trudgeon.
Okay. Before we have the guest talk, I would like to tell you, because I don't think I've told you this before, John Rose and I came into the legislature at the same time. And John Rose was an excellent excellent promoter of Roseville and an excellent legislator. And so I remember him fondly. And then also, as I told you at our recent little visit, I didn't know this was the Guidant John Rose Oval. And that led me to think about naming rights. And sometime before we begin our talking about what bills should be in a capital investment bill, this committee is going to have a conversation about naming rights and what's happening across the state with projects with naming rights before or during or after the projects are built in, and more of a clarification. And so keep that in mind as we go along, because I've never thought of it as the Guidant John Rose Oval. It's been John Rose's Oval. Please begin your conversation.
Thank you, Chair Murphy and members of the Capital Investment Committee. We appreciate the opportunity to come in front of you and talk about the Guy and John Rose Minnesota Oval located in Roseville and the need for funding for it. My name is Pat Trudgeon. I'm the city manager for the city of Roseville. With me today also is Nick Pearson, the program director for the Midway Speed Skating Club and a former two-time Olympian who has trained and skated at the Oval. As some of you may be aware, the Minnesota Oval was built in 1993 with state bonding money. The Minnesota Oval is a very unique facility, as Representative Becker Finn mentioned. It's the largest continuous outdoor sheet of refrigerated ice, weighing in at 110,000 square feet. It's truly one-of-a-kind facility, certainly in the state as well as the country. In the ensuing 25 years, the state's investment has allowed users from around the state, the country, and the world to use, train, and compete at the facility. The Oval has been a training venue for the amateur and professional athletes throughout time here, including 9 Olympic speed skaters. The facility hosts international, national, and statewide competitions, including high-level speed skating, world bandy tournaments, and recreational skating, where it's not unusual to have over 500 people skating on the sheet of ice all at once. The Oval is a national training center for speed skating, the home of USA Team Bandy, the Greater Minnesota Speed Skating Association, as well as the Midway Speed Skating Club. The Oval just turned 25 in December, and many of the major components and infrastructure as part of that are at the end of their useful life, and capital improvements are necessary. The Minnesota Oval has always been a partnership with the state of Minnesota since it opened in 1993. The state provided funding to help get the Oval built. Since that time, the city has funded the operation and the maintenance of the Minnesota Oval, and the state has contributed back to the Oval several times since the original bonding in 1998 for an addition of a banquet room as well as a locker and meeting rooms. In 2006 for an entry addition and additional capital improvements in 2008. To help understand the magnitude of our need here, we did commission a professional condition assessment report, which you should have as part of your material, with the original engineer looking at the Oval, giving an assessment and making recommendations to help it continue operating in the future. Based on that report and other identified Minnesota Oval facility needs, we estimate about $5 million is needed to make the necessary improvements, the needed health, safety, and efficiency capital improvements we need to keep it operating. As we have talked about, this facility serves the entire state of Minnesota throughout time here, so we think it is a worthy investment. As I mentioned in your packet, you should have the full report that gets in the detailed breakdown. I would also point to you a one-page sheet that's also in there that kind of loops some of the improvements together so you have a better sense of what we're talking about there. So thank you, Chair Murphy, for allowing us to come in front of you. I look forward to working with the Capital Investment Committee as the bonding process continues. I would mention just real briefly in regard to the guided naming rights here, that was at a point of crisis for us when we had to shut down the Oval because of some equipment failure for a whole season, and Guidant was able to come in and help give us the necessary dollars to help make that improvement here. We were in close consultation with John Rose's family and his wife, and they endorsed that move, but I just want to make sure that was clear to the committee as well. So that's the end of my testimony, if it's all right. If Mr. Pearson could say a few words, that would be great.
Yes, Mr. Pearson.
Yep, thank you, Chair Murphy and members of the committee. It's my pleasure to be here today to speak on behalf of speed skating and the very important Guy and John Rose Minnesota Oval. I am Nick Pearson, two-time Olympic speed skater and current program director for Midway Speed Skating Club, which is based at the Oval in Roseville. You've heard from Pat and on the local impact skating has with its programs and its public skating. I'm here to talk about the impact the Oval has on the sport of speed skating as a whole. The Oval is only one of 5 speed skating ovals in the entire country. Since the Oval opened in December of 93, 9 Olympic speed skaters have come from the state of Minnesota, all training out of the John Rose Oval at some point in their development. In that same time period, there have been 7 Winter Olympic Games held. So if you do the math, at least one person from Minnesota has been at each one of those Olympics. And that kind of shows you the impact that the Oval has on the sport of speed skating. And will continue to have with your sport. names like Amy Peterson, Amy Sanis, Jason Headstrand, Ann Driscoll, Rebecca Bradford, all Olympic speed skaters that from Minnesota that have trained there at the John Rose Oval. I'd like to thank the state of Minnesota for their years of support at the Oval and ask you to realize the importance it is to the state and to the sport of speed skating and continue to support it well into the future. Thank you.
Representative Nornes.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just a quick question, I guess. The picture looks very nice, and I'm just curious, is there a Zamboni that maintains the ice for you?
Yes, and we have some special other equipment as well. It's refrigerated underneath, but we still need to clean that surface on a regular basis.
And I didn't see a Zamboni on the list of needs, so apparently that's not...
That's correct.
That's okay.
Yeah.
Okay, and in the summertime, is this property usable for anything else?
Yes, we use it for a lot of events offered by the city and draws people in from around the area. We operate a skate park during the summer times, so for younger folks can try to be daring and do jumps and everything like that. And we often hold movies and other events throughout the year there as soon as we can, given the weather and everything.
Madam Chair, just a comment. I would guess this winter you've been able to cut back on your electrical, whatever you use for refrigeration, just let Mother Nature do it?
Well, a little bit, but we want to make sure it's in the proper temperature and the proper range. At this time of year, typically with the sun, most neighborhood ice sheets will be melting, but ours won't because we have it controlled.
Okay.
Representative Lee.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Representative Beckerfin, for bringing this forward. The first question is, where is this located in Roseville?
Madam Chair.
Representative Beckford Finn.
Thank you, Madam Chair. That's actually a great question. It is located near City Hall, which is off of Lexington and County Road C. And the great thing about that is that of the transit that we have available in Roseville, we do have a bus route that goes right near there since that's where our City Hall is. So it's also really nice. You wouldn't even if you didn't have a car, you could still take the A line and one of our local bus routes and get to the Oval. So, located in my district.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And maybe this is for Mr. Trojan. Can you just talk a little bit more about some of the public programs that you have, and also what is the cost for the public to access the facilities when you're not having competition or training or all of that?
Mr. Trojan.
Yes, so we do have rental fees for skates if people don't have skates, and I believe the price of admission is $6 for the public skate on that. I'm not sure what we do exactly for competitions. There might be some admittance charge for that, but usually the main users are people associated with groups, the speed skating clubs, and they pay for ice time to help offset our costs in maintaining and staffing that.
Representative Lee.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Last, final follow-up question is, are there anything in place to help, you know, maybe community groups or groups that may not have the means to access the facility?
Yes, we always work with groups. I'm sorry, Madam Chair. Yes, we always work with groups here, especially if we can foster some new inroads to communities that don't typically ice skate. We always are willing to talk, and we have programs and the associations that are surrounding as part of the users of the groups also work with new users and try to get new people involved in the sport.
Thank you. Representative Becker-Finn.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I would also, you know, one of the larger users of the Oval are our youth hockey programs, and I know Roseville Area Youth Hockey does a lot of outreach in trying to get new folks interested in hockey and making sure that cost is not something that's keeping kids from learning to skate and getting involved in our ice sports.
Representative Lilly.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Representative Finn, it's really value this. This is definitely a statewide asset that's out there and doing great work, and I've been there a few times myself, but it's really a lot of things going on. Traditionally, I'd always been there playing hockey, but last year I had a chance to play bandy, and I was in pretty good shape last year too, but it was like, that is quite a game. So it's like a hybrid of lacrosse and soccer all blended into with hockey as well. So it's a neat game. But I was just watching over the tournament over the weekend for the girls hockey, and one of the top 25 players they mentioned was a woman from my school district, and she's switched over to she's training to speed skate, and so that's pretty neat, Allie Thunstrom, and so hopefully she's got a shot, but that's what you're working on, too. A lot of different things, good things going on over there.
Thank you.
Thank you. Seeing no other questions, we thank you for coming, and we'll be in touch.
Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Second item on the agenda is Representative Gomez, Minneapolis American Indian Center. Welcome, Representative.
Thank you, Chair, Madam Chair, and members of the committee for having us today. I'm really thrilled to be able to share with you all the vision for really expanding what is an anchor institution in District 62 and also in the American Indian community in Minnesota in general. The American Indian Center has been around since the 70s. It's located on Franklin Avenue in South Minneapolis, which is the American Indian Cultural Corridor. It's the historic home of the urban Native community, and it really is a beautiful example of an asset-based community development vision in a community that faces a lot of challenges. You know, there's a gallery there and a restaurant, which is actually a social enterprise that trains youth and brings food from Native groups around this, or Native tribes around the state and country into the urban community. It's very rooted in arts and culture. There's a craft store on site. There is workforce training opportunities that prepare community members for jobs and economic development opportunities. There's programming for elders and youth and health and wellness. And Mary's going to go into a lot of those details. But, you know, I just wanted to mention a couple of things that the center's been so critical in responding to some crises that we've faced in our urban community and in the urban Native community. They really have stepped up with the encampment that you may have heard about in Minneapolis that was largely Native folks, which is related to, you know, the opioid crisis that we're talking about a lot and to issues around trafficking. Beyond the programming that the center provides to folks in the immediate area, it also is a gathering place. It's a very important, it's a place where powwows happen, where annual celebrations happen, and where and that hosts funerals, that hosts you know, kind of a range of events of import to the community. So I'm really pleased to have Mary here with me. I did just want to mention a little bit about the history of this project in association with the state. They got $5 million as an appropriation in last year's bonding bill, and we're asking for $2.6 million more this year, which would complete that initial ask, because it came in lower than the portion that they asked the state to make up. They've made good progress toward the overall goals of the project, and so we're pleased to be here. With that, I'll pass it over to Mary Lagarde, who's the executive director of the Minneapolis American Indian Center.
Welcome to the committee, Director Lagarde.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. Again, my name is Mary Lagarde, and I'm the executive director of the Minneapolis American Indian Center. I'm also a member of the White Earth Nation. So the Minneapolis American Indian Center has been around since 1975. And it's one of the oldest centers of its kind in the country, and is located in the heart of the urban American Indian community. We have a lot of different programs within the center that are social service-based, you know, ranging from programs for our youth, including our Golden Eagle program, our Native Fitness and Nutrition program, and also cultural programs. We have programs for our elders that include programs for transportation, and then also programs that serve, you know, victims of domestic and sexual violence through our Indigenous Women's Life Net program. Also mentioned was the Workforce Innovation Opportunities Act program, which is our WIOA program. And that one, we actually serve unemployed and underemployed American Indians from throughout the state. So we serve 71 counties in the state of Minnesota. In total, you know, our clients come from 43 different tribes, so not just tribes from within the state of Minnesota, but from throughout the nation. And annually, over 43 individuals access our services. We also have a cafe, which is a culinary training program with healthy indigenous foods and an art gallery. We are located in South Minneapolis in the Phillips neighborhood, which is in the American Indian Cultural Corridor, and are a part of a 25-year master plan along that cultural corridor in developing that. So, you know, as Representative Gomez said, you know, we host a lot of cultural events and activities. And, you know, we estimate over 10,000 people visit the center each year. That is through, you know, a lot of different events that we have, you know, coming to the cafe, through the gift shop, visiting our art gallery. On February 14th of this year, we hosted the Missing and Murdered Indigenous Women's March. There were over 2,000 people that were at the Minneapolis American Indian Center for that event. In addition to that, you know, Indigenous Peoples Day events bring in hundreds of people. Other partnerships and initiatives at the center, we are part of the Metropolitan Urban Indian Directors, which you may have heard of before, often referred to as MUD. We have worked on the homeless encampment issue, and we'll continue to do that because the Navigation Center is going to be closing sometime before June. And I've also served on the Mayor's Multi-Jurisdictional Opioid Task Force. We have a number of other, you know, partnerships, including Minneapolis Police Department's Police Activities League, Indigenous Food Network, and then universities and colleges such as the University of Minnesota. Our capital campaign goal for the center is $15.2 million. And, you know, it wasn't something that we've just started. We've been working on this since 2013, starting with the community, going through a visioning process, developing a new strategic plan with the board and staff, exploratory meeting process with foundations. And in 2017, we were recommended for funding for pre-design from Governor Dayton in his budget and went through the legislative session and were awarded a $155,000 appropriation, which went through deed. And we were also able to leverage then funding from one of our local foundations, the McKnight Foundation, in order to get through more of a comprehensive plan for pre-design. Last year, as Representative Gomez said, we received $5 million cash appropriation from the legislature, and our total request had been $7.6 million. That is going through deed because it is a cash appropriation. We've been able to leverage other funding as a result of that, which we wouldn't have been able to do without the state funding. Margaret A. Cargill has been one. And just recently, we've officially launched our campaign. And committee members that we have, Minneapolis Mayor Jacob Fry, Minneapolis Police Chief Arredondo, Red Lake Treasurer Sam Strong, whom I think most of you have heard speak. Also, Karen Clark, who some of you may know, and I think she's here today. And then others, including Justin Heineman, who is the Executive Director of the NV3 Foundation based in New Mexico. So the plans for the Indian Center that have been developed include a total renovation of the interior of the building and a one-level expansion. The one-level expansion would add just over 18,000 square feet. And really, you know, it is about a shared vision for the center. So we took what we heard from the community to develop the new space. A big part of this is adding new space for our social enterprise programs. So that includes our cafe, also with our fitness center, and then adding rental space, which is our meeting space areas, and adding a co-working office space. All of those, you know, we have completed business plans for. You know, so we have done all of that work. We'll be expanding our office space and incorporating a sustainable design and energy efficiency, and definitely updating the 1970s electrical and all of that. So the impacts are going to be great for the community. You know, I think that, you know, the biggest one is really strengthening the short-term stability and wellness. You know, and that is, you know, for the entire state, for our American Indian community. Because it's not just our urban American Indian community that accesses the Minneapolis American Indian Center. It is accessed by all of the American Indian communities from throughout the state. You know, we see that with you know, the center being accessed for polling sites by all of, most of the tribes in the state, and then for a lot of the different holiday events and extra activities by the tribes in the state. This is our existing floor plan, and this is the proposed floor plan. So you can see that there's definitely going to be expansions to it. And I'll just kind of go fast because I know I'm taking a lot of time. So it's going to be a beautiful building and something that's definitely needed along the American Indian Cultural Corridor. You know, there will be open spaces, an expanded cafe with some more meeting space areas there, and an outdoor seating space. Our art gallery will be moved to the interior of the building. Fitness center will be moved upstairs. And then we will be adding a teen tech center. So we are currently talking with one of the foundations, Best Buy, in adding that. Meeting space areas, which gets used a lot at the Indian Center. And then, in addition, you know, we will be relocating the staff spaces to the second floor. And in the future, this is not part of the plan right now, but we would love to be able to add a performance theater. This would be something down the road in another phase. Our budget was getting too high. So that is the plan for the center. And I am open to questions.
Thank you very much. We will take your project under consideration.
Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, committee members.
Thank you, Representative Gomez. Representative Claflin. South St. Paul Women's Suffrage Monument Funding Project. Welcome to the committee, Representative Claflin.
Good evening, Chair and members of the committee. I do
apologize. While this is my first bill before the committee, I know it's not technically before the committee, but I locked myself outside my office and the snacks are inside my office.
There is, excuse me, but there is no tradition of snacks for new people or any people coming before this committee.
That is very welcome to hear. That's not the case in others. I guess we have Girl Scout cookies. Yeah. I'm bringing a bill to have a women's suffrage movement monument in South St. Paul. And you may know that 2020 is going to be the 100th anniversary of passing the 19th Amendment, which granted women the right to vote. In Minnesota, we had already granted women the right to vote in certain elections, but this opened that right to everyone in all elections, all women in all elections. The women in South St. Paul were the first to vote after the passage of the 19th Amendment. It just so happened that there was a water bond scheduled, and they were the first to cast a vote. And as part of the celebration of granting women suffrage, it would mean a lot to South St. Paul and I think the other residents of the state of Minnesota if we recognize the contribution that Minnesota women and South St. Paul women played in history. I certainly feel a lot closer to that history myself. I didn't see the connection to the women's suffrage movement when I was studying it in elementary school in South St. Paul, and having that real connection where we still have people with the same last names as the women who cast their votes right after that amendment was passed. This evening, I also have Deb Griffith with me from the city of South St. Paul. I'll let her speak a little bit more about the proposal.
Good evening, and thank you for having me here tonight. So the
please identify yourself for the record.
Deb Griffith with the city of South St. Paul. And I'm too am a lifelong resident from there, and I didn't know this going through school as well. But on August 26, 1920, the 19th Amendment was ratified. On August 27th at 6 o'clock in the morning, the first vote was cast by Marguerite Newberg at 6 o'clock in the morning. It's interesting when we're going through the history to find out, too, there were two election boxes, one for the women and one for the men. And the story goes, and in fact, we have found the original minutes of the South St. Paul City Council meeting saying that so many women voted, so many men voted. And the rumor goes is that the women took the votes home to make sure that they were safe. So times have changed over the last 100 years. We also had another election 3 days later, so I'm not really sure how that all worked back then, but I find it quite interesting. We know who voted, we know where she voted, and it was the original City Hall. And that is now where Lashi Park is. Our original City Hall is no longer in existence. And that is where we would like to put the monument, where it actually took place. And why a monument and a statue is because there's one in Seneca Falls, New York, which was the start of the whole suffrage movement and the convention. And so we feel it's a way that they started with a monument and a statue, and what a wonderful way to end it with the statue. And we also actually have a photo of the first woman voting. And this hit many of the newspapers, and we're finding out more and more who the women are. We don't know who they all are yet. We know that there were 90 women that voted in that election out of 400 and some votes. So we are continuing to do the research with the Dakota County Historical Society, with the Minnesota State Historical Society, and so we're trying to recognize many of the women's names, but we're also finding out that their name may have been Mrs. Thomas Smith, never recognizing their name. So we're hoping to be able to find out who they are and invite the relatives back. So this not only is a South St. Paul celebration, we are going to be shouting it through the state, and why not through the nation? We were the first in the nation, and we want to be recognized for that. Thank you.
Representative Erdahl.
Thank you, Madam Chair. just wondering if you ever, are you considering putting any names of people on that? I mean, the founder of the suffragette movement in Minnesota was Clara Euland, and I think it'd be good to have her recognized.
I think there's, and that, you know, will be determined, but I think that's a very good point. I think there's a lot of things, and that's what we are studying it now, and we are going to have a year-long celebration starting in August of this year and then capping that off in August of next year. And so, yeah, all of those points we'd be very happy to listen to and make the best monument that we can.
Yeah, thank you.
Ms. Griffin, how did you come upon the $300,000?
Honestly, we took a look at what it cost to make the Mary Tyler Moore statue. That's in Minneapolis. It was a little over $200,000, and it's been like 27 years, and said, well, we look like we're going to need about $300,000 to do it.
Is Ms. Griffin, do you feel that the statue resembles any particular woman?
Well, one of the thoughts that we had was we have the first vote. Here's what it looks like. Here's what she looked like. Would it look like this? We haven't determined that yet, but we are definitely open to suggestions, and we are also working with our historian as well, too, and so we'll be gathering facts, and I don't know, to be honest with you, what we're going to come up with.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Clapper.
Thank you for your consideration. If you are interested in any of the other history of South St. Paul, I have the book.
We'll come to you.
Thank you.
Representative Moran. House Files 1067 for presentation. Welcome to the committee.
Good evening, Madam Chair and members.
Why are they kneeling?
All right, good.
Representative
okay.
Moran.
Okay, thank you, Madam Chair. So I just want to thank you, Madam Chair, and members for allowing this bill to be heard before the committee. It is a really, really important endeavor that is a part of St. Paul. In a community that sits on the green line where its diversity is a strength, where many believe that somehow many of our in our community have been left behind, undervalued, underserved, and has not always been inclusive of diversity that make up the community. It was a community of people who saw the need for the Victoria Theater and decided to prevent it from being demolished. Not only did they prevent it from being demolished, but they also was a community of people who saw a vision for what the Victoria Theater could mean for a community. And so I'm not going to talk long about the intro of the Victoria Theater because I have a group of community folks here that I think can speak so much better than I about why it would be important for the state of Minnesota to invest in the Victoria Theater in a community right here in St. Paul. Thank you. So I have some testifiers here. The first one will be Damien Strange.
Mr. Strange, welcome to the committee and tell us about the theater.
Great. thank you, Madam Chair, and members of the committee. My name is Damien Strange, and I'm going to be talking about Victoria Theater. I think you have this in front of you. The building is located on University Avenue between Victoria and Avon, right on the green line there, and it's about a century old. My wife and I live in Frogtown with our 15-month-old son, Ezra. I'm a board member and treasurer of Victoria Theater. I have and currently serve on many other boards, including on the boards of Headwaters Foundation for Justice and Compass. I served for 6 years on the board of the Metro Regional Arts Council, and I'm a composer and sound artist. And I also know a little bit about innovative startup arts organization, as I was one of the co-founders of Hope World Music Collaborative North in North Minneapolis. Today, I'm honored to be able to speak to you about what I feel to be a beautiful necessity that is the Victoria Theater Arts Center. We come to you today prepared. Over the last few years, we have done the work. We have raised over $1 million in private and public funds, have a realistic 3-year operating budget that includes an annual $50,000 operating subsidy for the first 5 years that will be raised during our capital campaign. We've hired an architect and have a purchase agreement with the Land Bank Twin Cities for the next 2 years. The Victoria Theater will be a critical space for preparing our world's best workforce. Victoria Theater is a space for youth to work with caring adults who can help them develop skills in cross-cultural communication, teamwork, critical thinking, adaptability, and innovation. It is an intergenerational space for elders to express themselves too, a space to help break social isolation. It will be a space where multiple generations can interact, play, and cultivate the beloved communities we all yearn for in our respective local ecosystems. It is our belief that local communities must be strong. The hands and decision-making starts at the local level with intergenerational action. As an artist, I fully understand the necessity of a space that feels safe to experiment, build art practice, develop your voice, and nurture the fertile fields between our young people's ears. And as a new father who was himself raised with an appreciation of the arts and how important the intersection of art and community are to cultivating and sustaining a vibrant community, it is my dream that Ezra or one of his peers will be speaking in 17 years at their high school graduation and say, "I am where I am because of the seeds that were planted at Victoria Theater."
Thank you, Mr. Strange.
Good evening, Chair Murphy and committee members. My name is M.K. Nguyen. I am a proud mother of a 3-year-old and a community auntie in the St. Paul Promise neighborhood. I'm also the daughter of Vietnamese bread makers who have established a bread shop right next door to the Victoria Theater. And as a girl, I remember my family following the migration patterns of Southeast Asian and East African business owners. You may have tasted the bread that my parents have been making for the past 34 years. So if you've ever tasted a banh mi at Nicholas Eat Street, or Brooklyn Park's Golden Lion, or Burnsville's Oriental Market, or Rochester's Asian Direct, or if you've ever bought a 4-roll bag of French bread at the East African stores in the West Bank, or have enjoyed a plate of slow-cooked fava beans at the Red Sea or the Five Star Cafe, chances are that you have tasted my parents' love. My parents' story resonates with the story of many artists that we see in the Frogtown Rondo neighborhood. In order to learn how to make a living, We had to learn how to export our gifts. And we gave it very generously and freely to people outside of our neighborhood. Frogtown Vanu sits at the foot of this state office building. This neighborhood alone speaks 26 different languages. I think that the Victoria Theater can be an incubator for the story that Minnesota tells itself. So with that said, I would actually like to pass the microphone to the next generation of storytellers and introduce to you Ian Marquez.
Thank you, Ms. Nguyen. Mr. Marquez.
Well, hi. Good morning, Chair Murphy and committee members.
Good morning.
My name is Ian Marquez. As a young artist, I go by Yasin. My family and I have been residents of the Frogtown community since 2003. I previously worked within Frogtown Farm as the community ambassador, and currently I work for U.S. Bank and independently as an artist. I feel like the Victoria Theater is imperative to the community's development. In Frogtown, we've recently had a major boom when it came for green space, but being able to have a hub for artists to come together and create would help shape and push our community in an equally positive direction. Being a resident of Frogtown and an artist, I've had the pleasure to perform at the Victoria Theater's events. The lasting impact of us being able to share spaces and stories with our neighbors, being both young and old, it made me feel like we were tapping into something special. Being able to see the genuine smiles on everyone's faces after everything was said and done, I mean, it was just amazing. It felt like we were all growing together as a community. And I feel like spaces like these are a key element of something that we lack within Frogtown. I think the biggest takeaway from it for me was the Victoria Theater was able to create a safe space that allowed me to be vulnerable and grow with my community. And that was through the arts, you know, through dancing and things like that. And it made me feel welcomed and like my voice was actually being heard. Yeah. Lately, I've actually had to, like, host artist get-togethers within my own home because of voids like these. So that's why I feel like it's important. Thank you.
Thank you, Yasin. Do we have another story, or?
No. Zahara, she's practicing podcast. She's part of a group that we created called Visions and Ballads. And so she's just here capturing the sounds of the beautiful soundscape.
Thank you, Ms. Nguyen. So, Representative Moran, tell me what the art space is right now, or what the Victoria Theater is right now.
So, and I might ask for some help from the EV, but the space of the Victoria Theater that's located right off the Green Line on Victoria in Avon is a historical structure. It surrounding just the space of the building has been a place where community can come together to host events, to bring community together around the arts, but currently it's a structure, it's the building.
Right. And it's being used now?
It's not being used.
No.
It is not being used. Okay. So the funding that we're asking or requesting would be to do some of the demolition works, the improvement of and replacement of mechanical, electrical, plumbing, heating, ventilation, and air conditioning systems. It's also going to be used to repair the roof. So it's going to get the structure of the building in place so that community can have a place to come together and as in the spirit, and I know you guys felt that way I was feeling about what this means for a community like St. Paul, the historical St. Rondo community that was displaced by I-94, to look at the diversity within the Frogtown community and bring together that diversity that is about community, local ownership, local business, building the capital together.
May I also add something?
Yes. And Ms. Nguyen.
Oh, thank you very much, Chair Murphy. So the building is currently not used now. It was used
for a lot of community engagement activities and processes until the city said, you can't use it anymore until you get until you make these renovations. And so informally, we did host a lot of different things that you will most likely see in this in these renderings. But after we got the official notice that we were not actually legally allowed to use the building, we stopped using the building.
Okay. And then when we get the bill, if the appropriation is part of the capital investment bill, then you will get an appropriation, and then what will the building be afterward? It's still going to be called the Victoria Theater, but it's not going to be a theater, right? It's going to be an art center, a place where people do art and do community work, and a meeting place.
Madam Chair, committee members, yes, that's correct. It is intended to be, my name is Chris Wilborn. I'm also a board member and a community artist. It is intended to be both a community space as well as a performance center. We intend to have the space have flexibility so that we can host a number of different types of events and gatherings so that we can serve the community in as many ways as possible.
Representative South.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a technical, who owns the building right now, the structure? Who owns it?
It's the Twin Cities Land Bank that actually owns the structure right now, and we have an agreement with them where they own it, and we're making payments to them for the next, I believe, two years so that we can go through the process of renovation during that time and then take ownership.
Representative Sopp.
So, Ms. Decent, does that fall in the slots that we need it to fall into, or does there need to be some accommodation for the grants? Just This is a technical issue that we have to at least have some grasp of.
Ms. Deason.
Madam Chair and Representative Sock, the money would go to the City of St. Paul to acquire the property. So,
okay.
All right. Once the city owns the property, then the state bond funds can be used for the renovation.
Representative Sanston.
He took my question, Madam Chair.
Okay. Any other questions? Thank you very much.
And Madam Chair, I just want to say, just for the purpose of the committee, that the Victoria Theater is a priority on the priority bonding list for the City of St. Paul. So we do have that support.
Ms. Nguyen.
Yes, Madam Chair.
Now, what is that bakery that's next to the Victoria Theater called?
It's called Ala Francis Bakery. We do wholesale in the back, and then we just export it out at per usual. And then we have this beautiful family who owns this Ethiopian restaurant called Demira, who utilizes our storefront. Yep, and I just want to also note, we are the first banh mi shop in the entire state of Minnesota, starting in 1985. And we actually taught my uncle, which is the owner of Jinram Bakery, right, who has infamously delicious croissants, right, and his skills. His son actually migrated to St. Cloud and helped run his parents-in-law's business and brought bread into the St. Cloud area, right? If you've ever visited Vientiane, you have tasted the bread that has come out of our Frogtown neighborhood as well.
Okay, thank you very much. And that was our commercial message for this. Because I was trying to figure out if it was part of that wonderful croissant place. I speak to them at 6:45 some mornings because I knock on the back door and he lets me in.
So, Madam Chair, is
but I have to have the correct change. Representative Moran.
So, Madam Chair, I just want to again to say thank you for the opportunity to present in front of the bill, the committee, and I would just love to have the support of this committee to really serve locally right here in St. Paul for a local community that is that is so ready for this opportunity.
We haven't heard about the farm yet, and we're going to hear about the farm. What's your connection with the Frogtown Farm?
You know, okay.
If this was morning, we would not be doing this, members, but these questions keep popping, commercials keep popping up, and so I just got to get that one out of the way right now while you're here in real person.
Yeah. I mean, we've got some really great people who can also talk about Frogtown Farm, but Frogtown Farm is a local entity that really has really found the space that created some really green space right in St. Paul that really takes you away from the feel of the city into another space where they are really have captured and nurtured the land. I'm sure I have someone.
Are you connected with them or going to be connected with them through your arts?
I'm one of the volunteer farmers at the Frogtown Farm.
Yep, and then we have also a Frogtown Farm youth ambassador who's also with us.
Okay, Yasing.
So previously, what was it? It was the hill off of Victoria and Minnehaha. I believe that used to be where the Wilder building used to be. I'd say maybe about 10 years back. And that was actually renovated to the point that we were able to use that space as a 14.7 acre farmland that was designated for the community to help teach kids about urban agriculture and things like that. Yeah, the way that I got started with that was I had the chance to meet Satu Jones while I was working with Youth Farm and teaching other kids about urban agriculture. And after talking with him for a while, the job had posted itself, and then that's how I was able to be a part of that. Yeah.
And you think that you can find the farm useful for some common things together?
I'm pretty sure we could find some ways.
Yeah, certainly I think there will be opportunities to use the theater space to showcase the things that the farm is doing. Obviously, that farm is not actively functional during the winter months. The theater would be. It would be a place where seminars and classes for the farm could be taught, and vice versa. In the summer, it might be a place where they can offer up some of their more open space for outdoor performances or galleries that might be curated by the theater. It's something we would definitely talk about.
Thank you very much. Good luck.
Thank you very much.
Representative Juergens. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm here to present House File 1106, which is a $2 million appropriation for asset preservation for the City Hall in Hastings, Minnesota. Many of you that were on the bonding committee last session toured the Hastings City Hall. Justin Fortney on my right is a city planner that showed us around that day, showed us where a lot of the masonry, the bricks, and the mortar are flaking, and what the needs are. In fact, Almanac was videotaping that day, so there was actually a production on TPT that next weekend showing some of the presentation that we saw that day. This is, a $2 million appropriation. Some of the work has been started. This has increased slightly from what our request was last year for that reason, and Mr. Fortney can talk about that to some extent of some of additional needs that were uncovered when they started the work. On my left is the interim city administrator, Julie Fladden. She will also testify, and we'll take any questions that you have at the conclusion of this. But this is the second oldest county courthouse in the state of Minnesota, the former Dakota County Courthouse, now City Hall. So it has regional significance for that reason. And as we know from preserving our Capitol building, how important it is to preserve those buildings for our future so that people will just for preserving that for the future. And at that. Julie Flatten, introduce yourself.
Ms. Flatten, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair and committee members. My name is Julie Flatten. As Representative Juergens said, I'm the interim city administrator for the city of Hastings. And as he also mentioned, we're here to talk to you about a partnership to preserve our historic city hall. We have identified the needs to maintain this building at $4.6 million, of which we are asking for $2 million. The structure was constructed in 1869, served as the Dakota County Courthouse from 1871 to 1974. In 1993, the building was purchased and it was renovated by the city, and it served as our city hall ever since. So for the past 26 years, we've been working to carefully maintain this asset, and this asset is used extensively by the public, tourists, photographers, and our local theater groups. We've leveraged several historical grant funds, and we've been setting aside funds for several years in anticipation of large capital repairs. Over the last 2 years, we've worked with many field experts who have helped us identify the structural, operational, and functional deficiencies we have. And though there are areas of concern with the building, it is structurally sound and worthy of continued investment. In your materials, you have a letter of support from our mayor, Mary Fassbender, encouraging a state and city partnership to continue to maintain this historic landmark. I'll let Justin Fortney speak to the details of our project. Thank you.
Mr. Flatten.
I'm sorry. Thank you very much, Madam Chair and committee members. This Italian villa-style building originally had a center cupola in the style of the French Second Empire to match the corner towers. Over 40 years later, in 1912, the main cupola needed major repairs, and it was removed and replaced with a large dome circular cupola in the Renaissance Revival style. You can see these two different styles in the photograph of the handout. The reason they changed the style of the cupola was because it was more popular at that time for government buildings. The dome and the corner towers have now gone another 107 years without needing any major work. Due to their solid design, construction, and like the rest of the building, it's received regular maintenance over the years. Now, after 107 years, the painted galvanized roofing and ornamentation around the top of the building is at the end of its lifetime. Even by maintaining the sealed joints, regular painting, and inspections, the metal has corroded from the inside out, and the organic underlayment of the roof that protects the building from water infiltration, it has dry rotted just from the sheer age of the product. The rehabilitation work is unique for several reasons. First, it's highly specialized work that only a few firms in the state are capable of performing. The current configuration must be drafted by a historic architect before firms can even bid on the project, and the State Historic Preservation Office must approve the exact work prior to beginning the project. There's also a highly probability of unforeseen costs during the project as unknown issues are uncovered, which is what we've experienced with our current masonry project. Fortunately, with the use of modern underlayment and modern coatings, the new roof and ornamentation would look just as grand as it does today, but will outlast the 107 years of the existing materials. The city has placed a great deal of investment in this building over the past decades and will continue to do so in the future. The building is the oldest government building still in operation as such in the state, first as the courthouse and now as the city hall. The building is open, free for the general public for self-guided and formal tours, photography, and we offer extensive art collection for viewing and maintain a free museum and historic research center called the Pioneer Room, run by volunteers for helping people do historic research on genealogy and properties. We have meeting rooms available for use and make the building available for organizations, businesses, musicians, and theater productions, along with weddings, as mentioned by Julie. And I'd like to thank you for helping us to maintaining the historic asset for future generations of Minnesotans.
Questions?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Now, this is the, if I'm figuring right, is this the 150th anniversary?
Approximately. It was built in
1869. This is 2019.
Yeah.
I think that's 150.
Representative Erdahl, were you a math teacher or?
I've got a calculator with me. You guys should be doing something for the 150th of this building.
This is it. This is the start of it, Representative.
Madam Chair, I'd just like to say that I did tour this building on our bonding trip a year ago. I'm a big fan of the restoration of the historic buildings, and this one is certainly noteworthy for many things. Not just the style and construction of it, but the fact that it was also the office at one time of Dakota County Attorney Harold Stassen, who became governor of the state of Minnesota and a frequent presidential candidate, and certainly one of the famous Minnesotans. So his office was there, and I think there's a lot of history that needs to be remembered.
Representative
Sauke. Anything's fine. I know this sounds like I'm way in the weeds. If you can just give kind of a general answer. Have you done an engineering study to have some sense of how deep you understand what's there, knowing that it's that you can't get there till you start taking it apart?
Mr. Fortney.
Thank you, Madam Chair. In 2016, we had Collaborative Design Group, a historic architectural firm, review the building and look at the entire envelope and structural soundness of the building. And they believe that there's no structural issues with the dome. It's believed that it's just the exterior material, the metal roofing, and the underlayment that needs to be replaced.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. We will hold this over for further consideration, like all the others.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative Cleburne. Welcome to our committee. Please begin.
I apologize first to the committee for not having the handout to you previously.
Please begin.
Madam Chair, I am here today representing the City of Plymouth, which I'm one of the four representatives on this bill, House File 1451. The others are Representative Winkler, Representative Acum, and Representative Lyndon Carlson. All four of us come before you asking for your support for this bill. Plymouth is requesting a matching state contribution of $15 million to offset the cost and renovation of the expansion of the Plymouth Creek Center. As Plymouth, the community area around Plymouth is growing, so does the demand for the 20-year-old Plymouth Creek Center. The available space at the Creek Center is insufficient to meet the current regional needs. Plymouth is now the state's seventh largest city, and our population is about 80,000 and growing. A recent feasibility study examining the growing concerns about the Plymouth Creek Center's ability to meet current and future needs shows that it is in need of expansion. This project is increasingly important as the population of the full four school districts serving the Plymouth area also grows to about 380,000 students. With me today are our mayor, Jeff Washey, and our park and recreation director, Diane Evans, and we are here to answer any questions that you have about it. I ask, please, that you would recognize our mayor.
Welcome to the committee, Mayor.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you to yourself and all the committee members for allowing us to make this presentation request before you. I just want to add a few comments, and then we can open up for questions. as well as our Park and Rec Director, Diane Evans. In addition to being the seventh largest city, we're also the third largest suburb in the Twin Cities. We're the fourth largest city when measured by GDP. Plymouth is home to over 58,000 jobs. In fact, Plymouth has a larger population during the daytime than we do during the evening. Specifically to the Plymouth Creek Center, this is for expansion and renovation of the existing Creek Center, which is a multi-use facility that includes an activity center, a field house dome, and Millennium Gardens. It draws 300,000 annual visitors across the region, and it's a complex that serves as a hub for arts, recreation programming, wellness, agency trainings, and other regional events. The Creek Center offers an array of programming for people just from infants, young children, all the way up to senior citizens. Just in 2018, Plymouth Creek served as a meeting space also for major companies such as Boston Scientific, the Minneapolis Heart Institute, Polaris, U.S. Foods, and many more, those are examples of that. Statewide agencies also frequently use the facility for training and conference space, such as the Freshwater Society, the Minnesota Recreation and Park Association, Special Olympics, and many more. Regional cultural events such as Primavera, the Plymouth Arts Fair exhibit, and the works of artists across the state and beyond. So just some facts about the Plymouth Creek Center. There's 1.5 million people that reside within 10 miles of the Creek Center. One in five Creek Center users in 2018 were from other cities. There's 150-plus regional events that were held there in 2018. And then we have open play for our young residents and non-residents, because in 2018 there were a little over 5,200, and of those, a third were from other cities. We host 18 regional athletics associations that utilize the facilities, 13 high schools, 12 universities all used the complex in 2018. On average, there's about 20-plus activities going on in a day, and all that is without the expansion. So we're hoping that this project, that you will entertain the request, will continue to increase our ability to host athletic events, regional conferences, and programs that benefit not just Plymouth but the entire region. With that, we'll open up for questions. Thank you.
Okay. Ms. Evans.
Excuse me, Madam Chair. I'm just here to answer any questions and provide support for our mayor, so thank you.
Representative Lee.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So I see on here that 13 high school and 12 university use the complex. Can you tell us, do they pay a fee to use the complex, or is it open to the schools for their usage?
Ms. Lee, or Ms. Evans.
Thank you, Madam Chair. The universities and high schools do pay a fee to use that facility. It is open, though, free of charge for those that come regionally and locally to use the walking facilities, especially in a winter like we have right now. We just get people from all over the metro area coming and walking inside our facility.
Seeing no further questions, we will consider this request when we start making our decisions.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, members, for your time and consideration.
Representative Mahoney. St. Paul East Side Freedom Library, which I read about in the Duluth Arrowhead region Labor World last week.
World famous we are. World famous.
Well, becoming so, evidently.
As it should, Madam Chair and committee members. I'm going to advocate for this library because it's a neighborhood treasure. And the things that it does for the kids and the immigrants that live in my district and on the east side of St. Paul, and in Roseville and in the Como area, all around, and it brings people from outstate also. it helps all these families. The Eastside Freedom Library is not only a treasure, but it's an asset to my neighborhood, to our neighborhood, and to our state. It's a historic building, a Carnegie Mellon library. It has really kept alive the history of the East Side. I never knew until last year that I have a piece of the original state capitol building built over there, on, built into the backyard of somebody's house.
Mm-hmm.
That's, the, pardon?
I think we want it back.
It is a historic collection of labor history through its 20,000 book collection. It helps the young kids in the neighborhood with ESL programs, with a variety of other programs, from History Day to tutoring to books to reading, any number of different things. And it helps draw the neighbors together to know each other. That the neighborhood that it's in, the neighborhood that I represent, and the city of St. Paul is one of the diversest, most diverse cities in the state. And my district is probably one of the most, if not the most, one of the most diverse, and actually above the north side. It is. People that live in the particular area. It's a city-owned building. They, and the Eastside Freedom Library Foundation, I think it's a foundation, rents it, leases it from the city of St. Paul for like $1 a year, but they are responsible for the upkeep. And when he got the building, he had a full head of hair.
I think you can stop that.
I will say this, I'll finish with this. This bill is integral to helping maintain the library. It is for the installation of a new heating, ventilation, and air conditioning system for tuck pointing of the bricks, and foundational work around the edge, around the outside of the building. I'll leave it at that. I got a little closing comment, but I'll be good.
All right, Mr. Rackler.
Madam Chair and committee members, thank you for the opportunity to be here and talk a little bit about this project. I taught history for 30 years at McAllister College, and I live in the Dayton's Bluff neighborhood on the east side. My wife and I watched the east side neighborhood change radically, first as unionized blue-collar jobs disappeared, white people moved out of the neighborhood, new immigrants, immigrants of color from Southeast Asia, Central America, and East Africa moved into the neighborhood. And we were aware that people who had lived in the neighborhood for a long time were not rolling out the red carpet for their new neighbors. And we had the idea that now sounds like a cliche, but that we wanted to build bridges and not walls on the east side of St. Paul. And we thought that our skill set, mine as a historian, hers as a theater maker and teacher, that we could use art and culture as a vehicle to bring different communities on the east side together to share their stories and discover what they had in common. We looked at a number of buildings and discovered that the library was going to be available because the city had moved out. And it drove us in the direction of creating a library and using it as a cultural programming center. We have tapped retiring professors for books. We now have 20,000 books focused in immigration, labor, and African American history. And we have programming going on multiple times a day. Today, the History Theater in St. Paul brought a play called Neighbors about four different immigrant groups to the library, to an audience that consisted of a class of English language learners from Washington Technology Magnet High School and a group of 20 Karen women who come to the library every Wednesday with portable backstrap looms to weave. And so we combined their work with this theater piece and a conversation about what did the experiences of Somali immigrants, Karen immigrants, Norwegian immigrants, and Hmong immigrants have in common. So that's what we're doing. For a guy who's supposed to be a labor guy like me, I did a really poor job of negotiating our lease with the city, so that all the responsibilities for the building are on us. We're looking at more than $250,000 need to replace the HVAC system. We're working with an architect who specializes in historic buildings. We're working with a good firm to introduce the HVAC system. We've already replaced the roof, which was $60,000, which we got done. Unfortunately, the current HVAC system is so loud that many of us who stood too close to the speakers when we were younger and attending rock concerts have trouble hearing, and it's a terrible thing to have to choose between shutting off the heat and hearing, or shutting off the air conditioning and hearing. So it's not only efficiency, it's not only about being good stewards for the books and the Hmong archives that we have under our roof, but it's also so that people who come to the library can actually hear the programs that are going on. So we have been successful in gaining support from foundations, support from the City Star program, but we, facing this great need of replacing the HVAC system and looking at a large estimate for the tuck pointing that needs to be done, we need help, and we're hopeful to get the help from the state. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Representative Lee.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So this is more of a comment, and kind of to Representative Mahoney's point about the importance of this library. I just want to mention that here in Minnesota, we have the highest concentration of Hmong American outside of Southeast Asia, and probably I will bet that most of the archives that are located here at the Eastside Freedom Library may be the largest collection of Hmong archives in the world. And so yes. I just want to, share that with committee members to know about the significance of the library, not just for the Hmong American community here in the state of Minnesota, across the country, and globally, too. So thank you for
thank you, Representative Lee. And it's important to us that third-generation Hmong American kids come in who I say Nya Zhong and they don't know what I'm saying, but we're introducing them to their history. And we have white kids and Latino kids and African-American kids who are coming in and doing History Day projects about the Hmong experience. So that it's so important that the Hmong Archives is with us and hopefully now has a permanent home. Thank you.
Representative Salk.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. If you will allow me, I want to bring our attention to a class of architecture that's around us, all in front of us, and oftentimes we're walking past it and or ignoring it and allowing it to crumble. The Carnegie Libraries throughout our country, and maybe you know some and you can make this point a little better than I can, but they are all over our country, and they are significant structures in our history and our understanding of our culture and how we held on to it as long as we did. So I want to at least put the point on that here we have the opportunity to make certain that another one doesn't crumble and go away, and particularly one that has a huge store of wonderful history inside of it. So I invite you to share a bit about the Carnegie.
There are 85 Carnegie Libraries in the state of Minnesota, almost 1,000 Carnegie Libraries in the United States. Our library was one of three built in St. Paul in 1917. We did celebrate Representative Erdahl. We did celebrate the 100th anniversary. We did have the math. It is a Beaux-Arts building with beautiful arched windows. We have just commissioned, with support from the state legacy funds, a history of our building. and we are about to, it will be our first self-published book telling the story of this building. The public library on the east side of St. Paul, prior to the building of this library in 1917, was in the back of a pharmacy on Payne Avenue. And this was really part of quite a step in the idea of public libraries in neighborhoods. And so it's a very important history. And it's so interesting for me to see the descendants of Swedish, German, Irish immigrants come in and say, my parents and grandparents came to this building, and to have Hmong and Karen and Somali and Oromo and Salvadoran and Mexican kids come in and this be the first library that they're using. So I think we're in a moment in the United States where people are beginning to appreciate the significance of libraries as public spaces. And as Carnegie himself said, as schools for the Republic. Thank you.
Representative Lilly.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Representative Mahoney, thanks for bringing this forward. It's funny because I was going to say some of what Representative Lee said about the library there of the collection, but you really captured it better than I could ever. But it so it's neat that that's all there. I mean, there's it's a neat space, of course, the building itself, but I'm just kind of interested in some of the other things that are going on, and there's quite a few of us that are involved with Legacy, two former chairs and a vice chair over there and another former member over there, but it's just kind of neat to see what's going on there. And we had a presentation the other day from some folks that came in and some of the Corinne Weavers, and instantly we recognized it as, you know, being done in that space. We could kind of see in the background, and we knew where we had been there. And then the last time I was in your building, you actually had a Hmong artist that was hired, I think, by Legacy Dollars, painting a wall mural in the stairwell and of the Hmong story, I think, in St. Paul and beyond. Yeah. But it was pretty neat to see the Hmong, you know, the interaction of all these different funds. And so hopefully we can do our part, too.
Thank you. We currently, I want to invite you all, we currently have an exhibit of photography by a Hmong artist who was born in Laos, came as an infant, went to Inverhills, went to Harding High School, then Inverhills Community College, then the Minneapolis College of Art and Design, and then got a master's in fine arts at Yale. And she is now one of the most significant photographers in town. We have a beautiful exhibit of her work called The Fruits of My Mother's Labors. And this Saturday afternoon, we will have a public conversation between her and a Somali artist, Mohammed Mumin, and they are good friends, and they will talk about the role of art in both of their communities as ways of telling their stories. So it's so important that we've been able to create this space, given the hostility towards immigration that is such a tone in our politics right now in this country.
Thank you.
Ratcliffe, thank you. And if I may, I want to thank Jenny for making me feel comfortable and reproducing the materials that now you're all going to take home with you. And thank you all very much.
Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members.
You're welcome. Representative Bierman. City of Lakeview.
Yes, good evening, Madam Chair. Thank you. Before I begin, I just want to endorse that previous project, if I may, please. I was excited to hear about it, and these Carnegie libraries are very important in my former hometown. They redid one, and it was amazing. They combined the old with the new, and it has reignited life and activity in that space like I've never seen it before. So I don't know if that's appropriate for me to say all that, but sitting listening, I couldn't help but get a little excited. All right, but I'm here to talk about HF 935, which is a proposal for a renovation of Ritter Farm Park Environmental Learning Center. This is to get more kids and more adults out into this beautiful area of woods and prairie, and need a little help out there. Currently, a two-story farmhouse that was built in approximately 1942 is being utilized as an environmental learning center at Ritter Farm Park, which is a 340-acre passive park utilized by hikers, cross-country skiers, horseback riders, and many nature lovers, including my wife and an extended family and dog. We go there regularly. It is very beautiful. You should all come out and take a walk there sometime. But they are operating nearly a dozen environmental learning programs are held at the ELC, including Nature Detectives, Ritter Farm Park After Dark, Bird Banding, Spring Ephemerals, and Youth STEM programs. In addition to these programs, nature oil painting and sketching classes are offered at the ELC. The building is also well utilized by Boy and Girl Scouts, who reserve the ELC and park areas for group meetings, overnight campouts, and nature programs approximately four dozen times a year. Also at the park is a log cabin that was moved to the site in 2008. The log cabin was once situated in Savage, Minnesota, as a Japanese language school known as Camp Savage, which was operated by the U.S. Army. As part of two Eagle Scout projects, repairs to the exterior of the log cabin occurred along with the replacement of the roof. Preliminary plans are to renovate the entire inside of the cabin so that it can be utilized as the new ELC, which will include the construction of a handicap accessible ramp and a deck on the front of the cabin, along with the installation of a septic system and connection to an existing well on site. The existing two-story ELC needs significant repairs and upgrades to the roof, siding, windows, heating system, so this structure is proposed to be raised. On behalf of the community of Lakeville and the surrounding area, I ask for your consideration of the project. My testifier was unable to make it here this evening, unfortunately, so I will entertain any questions and answer to the best of my ability.
How did the Environmental Learning Center come into existence?
That is a good question. I think that it started with just field trips out to the park with schools that would utilize the land, and then they just started to begin to hold classes, and then
so it was older community before representative.
Well, it was originally a farm and private property, and was made into a park and set aside.
And city of
Lakeville.
Lakeville own it?
Correct.
Okay, thank you. Mm-hmm. And when did it become an environmental learning center?
Well, that's a good question. I'm not sure when they actually made that title. I can find out, but it's always been known simply to me as Ritter Farm Park until about a year ago. So I know there's been activity out there depending on the time of day you go. Weekends, Saturdays, there's usually groups out in the main space.
Thank you. Mm-hmm. Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Representative Herr. Welcome to the committee.
Good morning, Madam. Good morning, good evening, Madam Chair and committee members.
Morning's coming quickly, but let's finish the evening.
Yes, we will go fast here. So we're here today to talk about the Playwright Center. And I didn't ask the manager, is that okay for us to start or?
Yes.
Okay. So until a few years ago, I didn't know what a playwright was. It wasn't until my daughters were cast in a play called Kung Fu Zombies versus Cannibals. That's a real thing. This play is a post-apocalyptic story that touched on identity, culture, gender, and, of course, amazing martial arts. I later learned that the playwright, Sigmukta Vongse, or Mux as we call her, was a product of the Playwright Center. Mux is an award-winning Lao American writer, poet, and producer, and her works have been produced from cities between New York and Los Angeles. This story is not unique to just Mux. Since its founding in 1971, over 2,500 new plays have been developed at the Playwrights Center, and over half have found their ways into professional theater stages across the world. Inside its humble church home in the Seaward neighborhood, the Playwright Center has had a profound impact on the lives and careers of such playwrights as August Wilson, Lisa Damore, Marion McClintock, Jeffrey Hatcher, Maylee Yang, Rihanna Yazzie, Sigmukta Vongse, and Harrison David Rivers. Currently, the center serves 2,000 playwrights across Minnesota, nationally and internationally, but because the number of supported artists grows nearly 15% annually, the renowned programs and support have begun to meet their point of capacity. Having launched a capital campaign to address this capacity building need, they have identified a new facility and they intend to purchase and renovate it in the heart of St. Paul's Creative Enterprise Zone. The Playwright Center is now seeking bonding dollars support from the state of Minnesota to help launch this new chapter of one of the most renowned national arts organizations based firmly here at the center of the Twin Cities and of Minnesota. If it's all right with you, Madam Chair, I'd like to introduce our first individual who will speak.
Please do that.
Okay. So that is Jeremy Cohen, and he is the producing artistic director of the Playwrights Center.
Hello.
Hello, Mr. Cohen. Welcome.
Madam Chair, committee, thank you so much for having us tonight. It feels going ninth of ten that if we've learned nothing tonight, the arts in the state of Minnesota are vibrant and important and are leading the way for building better communities right now. And we have so many incredible communities here. It's an honor to have been part of that community for 47 years as the Playwright Center, and I'm very excited to share with you all. So thank you for staying late tonight. We appreciate it. May I address the committee?
Please do.
Thank you. The Playwright Center's vision is to support the changing face and voice of the American theater, to tell stories that reflect back not only our past and our present, but help to build us towards a brighter future. We have spent 47 years at the Playwright Center serving as an artistic home, a hub, if you will, for playwrights and theater artists of all kinds to come and develop their work. Like all great works of art, from paintings to hip-hop, from opera to Shakespeare, all of our most important art starts somewhere. And at the Playwright Center, we know, and as we say, theater begins here. As an artistic home for making new theater, we are not just producing plays for a couple of weeks where they run and then they end. We are making multi-year, deep, financially supported commitments to artists in order that they can make that work and so that they can build an entire body of work over a period of time, sustaining them. We talk strategically all the time about sustain, develop, connect. Those are our three critical strategic points, and it's what we live into every day. Currently, at the Playwright Center, we provide over $250,000 a year in fellowships directly to playwrights for them to develop their work. And a playwright said to me just this last week, I said, so, hey, I've got to talk to an amazing committee of people who, let's pretend they don't know anything. Tell me something that's meaningful to you. And she said, this is the highest paying, most deeply supported lab where I can safely experiment, I can learn with audiences and artist collaborators, and write towards the best plays of my life possible. And I thought that wasn't half bad. As our friend and partner, Representative Herr, mentioned, with the incredible growth in education programming and artist support that we have provided over the past decade, we are now at a moment where this vital artist service organization, the Playwright Center, has begun to reach our capacity. both in our current facility, where we have been for over 40 years, and at our current budget size. So in the past 5 years alone, we have gone from, for example, making 50 new plays a year to where we will be at the end of this current season, which is that we will be making over 75 plays a year. God help us. By building a visionary new theater-making and playwriting arts center in the heart of St. Paul, we are increasing our ability to eventually serve, to move from serving the 2,000 artists that we support now, as Representative Herb mentioned, to over 3,500 theater artists and playwrights, theater makers a year. And that is not only in the Twin Cities. Something that's really critical for us is that we have programs around Minnesota. And one of the things that we really prize in our programming is being able to serve theater artists, playwrights, and dramatic writers, and looking really at ways of bridging sort of rural and urban communities. Oftentimes we'll see that resource truly just in urban communities, and we really believe that we have needed to develop programs to support geographically around the state in particular, where we currently serve over 350 playwrights around the state of Minnesota. We believe that by building the center, we are creating a true gathering space, as we already have, but expanding one for writers, for community partners and collaborators, of which we have many, and to broaden the impact that playwrights can have on our civil and public discourse. As a result of these 75 new play workshops each year, we currently create over 350 jobs for Minnesota artists, including actors, directors, designers. And with the growth of this project, that growth will move us from 350 to over 500 jobs a year that we are making there in that building. In addition, we devote a significant amount of money to helping move these plays from the development stage into production at some of the amazing theaters, both locally in the Twin Cities, around the state, and around the country, and around the world. Recently, if any of you had gotten the chance to see it, we provided two play development workshops for one of our writers named Lauren Yee, who wrote a beautiful play called The Great Leap, about a Chinese-American basketball team playing a peacemaking basketball game over in Beijing, which of course coincides with the moment of the Tiananmen Square incident. We brought together partners in order to create basketball theater live and really figure out how to develop that work, because there's a lot of layups, not just a lot of page rewrites. We brought partners from Denver, from Seattle, Washington, and from around Minnesota to come and develop this play. It's opened in productions around the country now, including a very acclaimed off-Broadway production this past season, and most recently you might have seen it at the Guthrie Theater, where it just closed a couple weeks ago. Our ask to you to consider in the next bit of time, as you have so many incredible projects before you, is $4 million from the state of our $8 million project to purchase and renovate a 19,000 square foot facility in the heart of the Twin Cities, specifically designed for community members, for playwrights, for theater artists, and of course, for audiences. Of the matched $4 million, $3.25 million will be from private sources, and $750,000 will be from the sale of our current building in the Seward neighborhood. Our new building is located in the heart of the incredible South St. Anthony Creative Enterprise Zone neighborhood. Already, as many of you know, a great deal is in process to protect artist space in this neighborhood, subsidized artist space, so that artists can still live and work in the neighborhood before it gets turned over and they can't afford to live there anymore. The Playwright Center is, as an organization, we are directly choosing this space because we intend to really work with all the neighborhood partners, we have a number already, who also believe in preserving space for artists and understand that when we gentrify an area or a space gets developed, we risk losing any number of people from that area, and we're quite invested in protecting that, not just artist space, but the myriad diverse artists that represent the folks that we serve. We seek to celebrate our 50th anniversary season with the opening of this new Artist Center, the design for which includes a multi-use theater for multiple different theater organizations, flexible rehearsal spaces, multi-purpose classrooms for the high school and higher ed courses that we currently offer, community gathering spaces where folks can come and be in that Artist Center, and artist apartments for artists in crisis, as we experience a lot of times around the state of Minnesota, so that we can create free or subsidized space for them to live in helping build bridges to those moments. Madam Chair, with your permission, I would like to invite Rihanna Yazzie to briefly speak tonight. Rihanna is one of the many Playwright Center family of artists, and I think she can speak briefly on the impact of the center on her work and life.
Ms. Yazzie.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, thank you. Yes, my name is Rihanna Yazzie, and I'm a playwright. I'm also the founding artistic director of a Native American theater company called New Native Theater. And I can definitely say this experience talking to you is probably going to make it into one of my plays. So I came to the Playwright Center, and I moved to Minnesota. I'm an enrolled member of the Navajo Nation. I came to Minnesota because of the Playwright Center. And as a Native playwright, I had an opportunity to use what I had learned to begin to change the ecosystem of the local theater community here. And there is now a thriving Native American theater ecosystem because of the theater company that I founded 10 years ago. But that wouldn't have been able to happen unless the Playwright Center believed in me as a playwright. And in fact, I've received every single fellowship that the Playwright Center offers, from when I was an emerging playwright in 2006, all the way to becoming a mid-career playwright. I guess that happened a couple of years ago. And I've also been a core writer. Now, one of the things that the Playwright Center does is it enables artists to come to Minnesota and change the ecosystem. And the fact that the Playwright Center really is able to value the kind of work that we're doing, it has so many impacts, because it's not just me that received a number of fellowships, but it's also the enormous number of constituents that my theater company now serves. And even earlier tonight, you saw there was a theater at the Minneapolis American Indian Center in their next design phase. Well, that's because of my company, and that's because the Playwright Center brought me to Minnesota. And there's so many amazing playwrights that the Playwright Center brings, and I just really can see how this beautiful new design is going to continue to really strengthen our arts community. And this is how creating a home for even just one artist can create huge positive change and economic impact and healthy livelihoods for others. And I just want to thank you for your time.
Thank you so much. That clarified what was already said in the basic directions to us about what the Playwright Center is. But we have a much better understanding at this time now because you came.
Thank you.
So, Representative Herr, do you want to conclude?
I do, Madam Chair and committee members. So in closing, I just want to say that the Playwright Center's work is critical for incubating creative written innovations, lifting up stories of marginalized communities, and developing voices so that stories we would never otherwise hear get developed. I can't think of a better place for the Playwright Center to be than in St. Paul, and no project more important than that which lifts up stories of all Minnesotans. So thank you, and we'll entertain any questions that you might have.
Thank you so much. We will consider your proposal to us as we make our decisions in the future.
Thank you.
I think it's very interesting how the people have learned from the people that came before them this evening. And we're all connected.
We are.
almost all these proposals before us are connected in some way. And it looks to me like our largest group is from Ramsey County and behind something called the Battle Creek Winter Recreation Area.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
An exciting place to be on certain days, isn't it?
Yes, it is indeed. And hopefully we can get over there and use it. Would you like me to begin, Madam Chair?
Please do, Representative.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and members and staff. Thank you for having us today, this evening. It's been informative and really a lot of fun, I think, hearing a lot about these different projects. But House File 1481 is about the Battle Creek Recreational Ski Area and sports area, and so we're asking for $3.1 million of general obligation bonds, and this would go to the Met Council, and then the money would then go on to Ramsey County, and it's for design and construction of a Nordic ski and competition winter recreation area. Currently, right now, many of the kids and adults need to go 30 to 60 miles to have opportunities to train or to ski. So this would bring it an opportunity in the East Metro. There's a wonderful place over in Minneapolis Lakes area that's in Representative Lee's district, I think, or Representative Dean's. And many of the kids need to go over there. And imagine trying to do that in these last couple weeks during the cold weather and traffic. And so there's quite a bit of risk. But this could be a launching pad for competitors, or, you know, for around the country and the world. But it also is a launching pad for skiers that would maybe have an opportunity to go up to Duluth and ski at Deer Spear Mountain on the cross country area, or other areas around the state, or Grand Rapids, and get around, and maybe even the Iron Range, maybe even a few to Rochester, perhaps. I don't know if they'd go to St. Cloud, though. I'm not sure of that.
So, Lily,
they would.
Ms. Dugan came up and launched a new trailhead up in the Spirit Mountain area.
Yep, some wonderful skiing up there. So we're pretty excited about it, and I have this is last. Are you starting already? Oh, okay. So with me, I've been lucky enough. We've been kind of tag-teaming this. Last session it was Representative Juergens, and now it's my opportunity. So we're partners, very much partners in this, and so I'd like to pass to Representative Juergens, and he has a few words to say.
Representative Juergens.
For the record, Representative Tony Juergens, and thank you, Representative Lilly, for bringing this bill forward and for asking me to participate tonight. You know, last year we had a real special day in the House of Representatives when we had Olympic gold medalist Jessie Diggins and her family come to the House chamber, and there were, what, several standing ovations as we read a House resolution honoring Jessie for her gold medal win. And Jessie can't be here tonight. She's in Austria, I believe, competing, but we have her mother here. So Deb Diggins is at the table with us.
Much better.
And I want to thank Deb for coming. She can introduce herself, and she would like to share a few words on behalf of Jessie Diggins.
Ms. Diggins, welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair and committee members. Being honored at the state last year was probably the second most exciting day of Jessie's year. Obviously, winning the gold medal was a big event, but it was an incredible honor to be recognized here, and I think many of you had the opportunity to meet her. She mentioned when she was here about growing up and being supported by the terrific Nordic community in the state of Minnesota, which has produced a number of Olympians, some of whom were there with her and who grew up skiing at Battle Creek just as Jessie did. She started skiing at Battle Creek as a child. We dragged her there, and sometimes she went sledding, and sometimes she skied. But she came to love it and spent a lot of time training there in the summers and competing there in the winters. But the Battle Creek facility is in need of upgrades to remain a competitive location for skiers. It also gets used by the entire community, and as was mentioned, that skiing community travels all over the state to ski in various areas. Having more opportunities in the East Metro for skiers and both on competitive, for the youth to learn to ski, for people of all ages to get out and enjoy the winter would benefit everyone. And so Jesse it's very honored that she has the opportunity to have her name attached to this, and would like to encourage you to support this bill. Thank you.
Representative Juergens.
Madam Chair, there was a letter from Jesse. Did that get distributed?
Yes, it did.
Okay, thank you.
So, Madam Chair, members, if you could take a look at the video, but we're just going to show you some amazing footage here of a quick video. We should have sound because... I wish they had the sports commentators. And maybe we could get Mom to say what's going on here.
Yes.
There she is.
A particular event or particular contest?
This is the gold medal race from Pyeongchang Olympics.
So at this point, they're showing Jesse leading the way through the transition zone, tagging off to her partner, Keegan Randall, who is going out on... Each of these skiers does three legs. They tag to each other. And Keegan is going out on the final leg there and then tagging back in to Jesse, who's leading off the group up the hill in Pyeongchang. Oh, I'm sorry, that's not the final. Okay, there's one more tag going on. Okay. Here we go. Okay, now Keegan out on her final leg. Coming back down into the stadium.
They're really going fast.
They're going very, it's a big hill. It's a really big hill.
If you recall, the first Olympic Nordic gold medalist in the United States history, this is the race.
Yep. All right. And here they come into the final turn. And at this point, they're coming around.
Yeah. I wish we had the sound here because when the announcer says, "Here comes Diggins," it just gives you goosebumps.
Yeah. There we go. All right.
So we just want to kind of give you the flavor, and quite honestly, not to diminish the men's success in the sport, but our women have, I think, been a little bit stronger of leading the way. But with me today, I'd like to invite up Ramsey County Commissioner, or who's Jim McDonough. We also have a former representative and senator, now County Commissioner Mary Jo McGuire, is in the crowd. But I think Commissioner McDonough is going to say a few words. Okay.
Welcome, Commissioner.
Thank you, Chair Murphy. Before I get into my brief comments, and I have Bart McCabe, our Parks and Rec Director, that can really talk about the project in depth, but I wanted to make an observation that I think everybody left in this room is here to support this project. And after our presentation, I hope I can include all the committee members in support of this project.
And they deserve a compliment for how enthusiastic they have been the whole evening. They've been very attentively listening to the projects that have come before us. And they seem to be interested.
Well, Madam Chair, they've been waiting a long time.
Yeah.
We've been working on this project for over 7 years, and I look out here, and almost every one of these folks have been with us on this journey over 7 years, working in partnership with the community to advance this project. So a few brief, quick comments. Ramsey County's vision is a vibrant community where all are valued and thrive. Having an ample and reliable opportunities for people to participate in winter recreation at the Battle Creek Regional Park gets us closer to realizing this vision. Our board, and as Representative Leon said, Mary Jo McGuire, Commissioner McGuire is here, but our board has already committed $1 million towards this project, and as I said earlier, almost 7 years of working with the community here on what this project looks like and utilizing the expertise and strength of the community to advance this project. We've got an active and passionate group of supporters for this project that includes cross-country skiers, winter recreation business owners, cross-country ski coaches, nonprofit organizations that advocate for healthy lifestyles, conduct winter programs. And I'm going to point out, even the West Metro, there's two winter recreation areas over there. They're very supportive of this because the capacity at those two is just cannot manage the demand. And as was pointed out earlier, there's just no opportunities in the East Metro whatsoever for this. We've got a major shortage of dependable facilities in the East Metro. Even though we've got piles of snow out there this February, I want to remind you, November, December, and January of this year, for the whole month of January, it was pretty much brown dirt. And that's the peak of especially our competitive high school teams, our competitive youth programs, and there was nothing for them to practice on, hold their meets on at all in the East Metro. We really need reliable snow, and this investment, partnering with the state, with the county, with the community, will provide that opportunity not only for this generation but generations to come. It will help expand the support, the sport, bringing in many new young folks that maybe the next Jesse Diggins can be starting on this project at this site here, hopefully within a year or two with the support of this committee. So with that, Madam Chair, I would turn it over to Mark. He can provide you with some of the details. And then we also have a community member here that's going to speak to you.
Mr. McCabe.
Hey, Mark McCabe. I'm the director of the Ramsey County Parks Recreation Department. Thank you for having us here. And as was mentioned, yes, Battle Creek is a very unique facility. It's got unique topography, amazing trail system, great hills for sledding and snow tubing, but just doesn't have the reliable snow conditions that we need so much. This was a host site for a number of significant events in the past, but these world-class events now require that there's reliable snow, and so that means machine-made snow in order to be awarded to be a site. So we're looking for that consistency to be able to be awarded such events that we can host those in the future. Again, we have this very passionate constituent group here that is supportive of the project. The project would be a 2.5 kilometer loop, lighted ski loop, and that's enough for high schools to be able to host their events, these other special events that we can bring in and be a host site for. That would accommodate that. So it's the snowmaking equipment, the infrastructure, cooling towers, all of those sort of infrastructure needs to be able to build that facility. There are many benefits, as have already been mentioned, including all the health benefits for people just to get out and enjoy the winter season and participate in these kind of healthy activities. We are looking to ease pressure from overcrowded areas in the West Metro and look for the economic benefits as well. The world-class events that we can host in the metro area at the Battle Creek site would be an economic benefit, as well as turning on thousands of people to cross-country skiing and having training activities and lessons, turning people into lifelong skiers and getting them out into greater Minnesota to spend weekends doing those sort of activities. Lastly, just want to talk about our desire, or the constituents' desire, to name the trail in honor of Jessie Diggins. As was mentioned, she trained out at Battle Creek Regional Park. We've been looking at trying to do the name the trail the Jessie Diggins Gold Trail in honor of her. The family is supportive, so we thank you very much for that. And would just love to get the support for this project and turn thousands of other Minnesotans on to this particular facility. So with that, I'd like to see if we can have Chrissy speak from the Minnesota Youth Ski League and represent that organization.
Ms. Snyder.
Good evening, Chairperson. Good evening, committee. My name is Chrissy Snyder, and I work for the Minnesota Youth Ski League. 2 years ago, I switched my career from being a preschool teacher and started working for the Minnesota Youth Ski League. And one of the main reasons I did that is because I saw that the 4- and 5-year-olds that I was working with, they needed to get outside more. Getting outside helped them academically. Getting outside helped them socially, emotionally. It helps them health-wise. And at the Minnesota Youth Ski League, we don't only get kids outside, we get the whole family outside all winter long. In the past year, MYSL's registration has grown 25%. We call this the Jessie Diggins effect with MYSL. There's kids all around the region right now, even boys, that are wearing Jessie Diggins socks and putting glitter on their cheeks, and they are ready to get outside in the winter. So we have over 2,500 kids this year registered for MYSL, and every week we get them outside. If you count the parents that we ask to come along and our volunteer coaches, that's over 4,000 people that we're getting outside on a weekly basis in the dead of winter. Families are looking for opportunities to get their kids off screens and learn a healthy, lifelong sport at a minimal cost, and cross-country skiing is the perfect fit for these families. Cross-country skiing has become so popular that we are now facing a scenario that we cannot grow our programming in the metro area anymore because there's not room on the 3 snowmaking loops. This year, for the first time, we are facing the realization that next year we may need to cap all of our registration and not allow other metro families into our programming because the 3 snowmaking loops are at or over capacity. This year, despite all of the snow that we have right now, we've only been able to meet at Battle Creek 3 times. When Battle Creek is not skiable, families are forced to drive to one of the 3 local snowmaking loops. And because of the huge demand for space on the snowmaking loops, I have to fit our 22 local clubs on those 3 snowmaking loops all weekend long, and everyone has to take turns, meaning that 4-year-olds are sometimes skiing at 7 o'clock on Sunday night because that's the only time slot available. At Battle Creek, we have 153 kids registered, but when we ask these families to now drive 30 to 45 minutes to get to a snowmaking loop, only about half of those families come. When we're at Battle Creek, almost all of those families come on a weekly basis. Snowmaking at Battle Creek would improve the lives of many families, not only in St. Paul, but throughout the metro area and the state of Minnesota. This fall, I talked to the gym teacher at Battle Creek Elementary School, one of the highest need schools in the St. Paul Public Schools. He is so excited to be able to bring his kids outside to ski at Battle Creek. In fact, there's already skis in the school. And I could help lead the programming, but the teacher needs snow in order to plan. local nonprofits such as Endurance United could help the Minnesota Youth Ski League start programs in the middle schools around Battle Creek, modeling it after the very popular middle school programs that the Lopet Foundation does around the Worth and getting underserved youth outside in the winter. If Battle Creek had dependable snow, high schools that attend school in the East Metro, such as in Stillwater and Hastings, will no longer need to drive for an hour both ways on a daily basis so they can ski on a snowmaking loop. Snowmaking at Battle Creek would also serve communities not in the immediate area. If we got this snow, you could almost hear cross-country skiers in the West Metro cheering that all of us from this side of the river are no longer clogging their trails. Battle Creek would serve as the training ground for club racers in elementary, middle, and high school. Just yesterday, I was on a conference call where they were discussing races at Mount Itasca in Grand Rapids or at Spirit Mountain in Duluth. And Battle Creek serves as the training ground for all of the East Metro kids that we would then be bringing up to Grand Rapids and Duluth on a weekend to stay at hotels, eat in the restaurants, and buy trail passes up north. MYSL also has a new adventure director. It's our former executive director. She's coming back to our organization, and she is going to be leading trips throughout northern Minnesota from the metro area. And I'd like to close with one story. I have a family that comes to the Battle Creek Club. They were former students of mine when I was a preschool teacher. They are immigrants from Ethiopia. The parents are terrified of winter. This is they just think, why are we here? This is insane. And it sometimes is.
They're right.
I thought that this morning as I was coming across 94.
Yeah, it is a little nuts. But on my urging, the parents signed their three daughters up to join cross-country skiing because the mother said that winter, after her first winter here, she just looked at me and said, "This is awful." And I said, "You've got to learn how to ski. It's the only way to do it." So they came. They only had to pay half of our $45 membership fee, and I got them their equipment for free. And they came, and they came every single week because luckily that was a year we had snow at Battle Creek. And those little girls learned to ski. This year they're back at Battle Creek, but it has been a struggle because they had to get to Bloomington. But in the past 3 weeks, we've been able to be right at Battle Creek because we have snow. And this past week, I skied the loop that would become the new Jesse Diggins Gold Loop with these girls, and they were so proud. Their dad, who's still terrified of winter and thinks there might be an issue if I bring his daughters out, he ran alongside them the whole entire time. And the girls are like, "Daddy, we can do this." And they were flying down the hills. And if you remember, last Sunday was when the blizzard was all around. And we still had skiing because in the hills of Battle Creek, it was beautiful. And you could see the Mississippi River, you could hear the trains below, and the girls were just delighted. And when we got up to the top of the hill, the winds were whipping, and I said to my little group, it's about 6 and 7 year olds that I coach, I said, "Well, I'm taking the shortcut in," and I had teenage helpers. "If you guys want to go down the big hill, you can, but I'm going in for hot chocolate." Every single kid, including my former student, said, "No way, we're going down the big hill and we're going to keep skiing." And that is the spirit that we bring to the winter. And that is what Battle Creek does for little kids and families. And when I finally got back in and when that dad got back in, he said, can you find me a pair of skis? Because I think that would be, this would be easier if I didn't have to run the whole way.
Ms. Snyder, I think you're still teaching. Thank you, Representative Jurgens. Thank you, Representative Lilly.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. I know it's late, but it's you can tell from the crowd and these stories, it's just it's a project of love and from the commissioners. But, you know, we've had these folks here, and one of them, Abo, raise your hand. He's a coach, too. He's in Finland, so you got to hear him talk later. We should have had him up here to talk, but he's a coach, two national champion cross-country teams for the men's University of Minnesota, I think, right?
Women.
There we go, nice. Again. So, but each of these have a great story, but it's thank you for hearing about this again, and it's been an honor to do this with Representative Jurgens, and thank you to Mom Diggins for coming out and everybody else.
And Madam Chair, just in closing, Minnesota was awarded a World Cup Nordic ski event for 2020, and so I will expect that the interest in Nordic skiing is going to continue to increase as we get closer to that World Championship and in the years beyond that. And this project, as you heard tonight, does have regional significance for a number of reasons. And I just thank you for your time.
Thank you. Thank you all for coming. Representative Lee.
Madam Chair, move approval of the minutes from February 26th.
All in favor?
Madam Chair. Madam Chair.
Representative.
There is one correction that I'd like to make.
Thank you. Please go ahead.
On the set of minutes that I have, and it looks like we might be receiving a new set, on the back side it says in the very second to the last sentence, Sandsted moved to reapprove the minutes from the 21st. That is not correct. I just approved them.
Okay. So are we on the new copy? Representative Lee?
Yep, Madam Chair, I move for approval of the new minutes that has that Representative Sandstad move to approve the minutes of February 21st.
All right. All in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed?
No.
The motion is adopted. Thank you so much for your endurance and your attentiveness and your smiles. Tomorrow morning, we will be back on rigid schedule, 7 minutes. We will start at 8 o'clock. This meeting is adjourned.